This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 7th of January. As Donald Trump says he won't rule out using military or economic force to take over the Danish territory of Greenland or the Panama Canal, we try to pass the US president-elect's words and get a response from an MP in Greenland. As Mark Zuckerberg announces his company is ditching its fact-checking service in America, we get reaction from Meta's independent oversight board. Plus, should England's cricketers boycott their upcoming match against Afghanistan, the climber who experienced the earthquake on Mount Everest, and as President Macron says that history will judge the legacy of Jean-Marie Le Pen, we assess the career and the influence of the French far-right leader. It was never going to be a low-key return. A day after his election victory was officially certified by the US Congress, President-elect Donald Trump was in front of the cameras today, using his Mar-a-Lago pulpit in Florida to, as he puts it, weave in and out of subjects. It was classic familiar Trump, a one-hour news conference that took in a mixture of threats, grievances and criticisms of his political opponents and of windmills. But with the added frisson of knowing that 2 weeks from now, his hands will be back on the levers of power. Mr. Trump said that NATO countries should spend 5% of their GDP on defence, suggested that Hezbollah may have been involved in the January the 6th attack in Washington. And on the day that his son Don Jr. visited Greenland, he responded to this question about one of the drums he's been banging since the election, the need for America to acquire or regain Greenland, the Panama Canal and Canada.
Can you assure the world that as you try to get control of these areas, you are not going to use military or economic coercion?
No.
And can you tell us a little bit about what your plan is? Are you going to negotiate a new treaty? Are you going to ask the Canadians to hold the vote? What is the strategy?
Yeah, I can't assure you. You're talking about Panama and Greenland. No, I can't assure you on either of those two. But I can say this. We need them for economic security. The Panama Canal was built for our military. I'm not going to commit to that now. It might be that you'll have to do something.
And then there was this follow-up about America's northern neighbor.
You said you were considering military force to acquire Panama and Greenland. Are you also considering military force to annex and acquire Canada?
No. Economic force. Because Canada and the United States, that would really be something. You get rid of that artificially drawn line and you take a look at what that looks like. And it would also be much better for national security. Don't forget, we basically protect Canada.
Well, let's speak to our North America editor, Sarah Smith. Sarah, it's a question I suspect we're going to be asking you quite a lot over the next 4 years. What should we make of all this?
Well, yes, it sounds ambitious, or I mean, frankly, it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? The idea of America taking over Greenland and the Panama Canal and using military force to do so if necessary. But Donald Trump, you know, this is his modus operandi, isn't it? To say these grand and ambitious things and keep us guessing as to whether or not he really means it. I mean, he has laid out an argument as to why he thinks that American control of Greenland is essential for its national security because of its strategic geographical position between America and Russia. And he has argued that control of the Panama Canal is essential for America's economic security and its economic competition with China. So he obviously takes this very seriously, but he wants us to keep guessing about whether or not he would use military force or how far he's prepared to go to press any of his claims. That is part of the strategy, that we don't know if this is an opening bargaining position or a literal plan of action. And he wants to keep his opponents off kilter and keep all of us unsure about what he may or may not do, because he thinks that that is one of his greatest strengths.
Yes, you mentioned Panama and Greenland. And, well, the other country mentioned today was Canada. Of course, its Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, who'd been down to see Donald Trump to try and talk him out of imposing 25% tariffs on Canadian goods. Well, he's now stepping down, and he seems a bit freer, perhaps, to speak his mind. He's sort of been reacting to this idea of America merging with Canada, as Donald Trump has said.
Yes, he's pretty forthright about that. He said there's not a snowball's chance in hell that Canada will merge with America, and I imagine most Canadians would probably agree with him. And of course, Donald Trump did not say that he was going to use any kind of military force to do that. He posited the idea that economic force might eventually join Canada to the United States. He sounded less serious about that than he did about some of the other places that he was talking about. Although he did, and this was interesting, talk about the billions, he says, it costs America to protect Canada. Now, he was probably talking about the balance of payments from other NATO countries. Canada, like the UK, is, of course, a member of NATO. And Donald Trump very much wants all the NATO members, other than America, to up the amount of money they spend on defence, because this has been a long bugbear of his, that he thinks that America is paying for the defence of these other nations. So he will be insisting, he says, that all of these countries put not 2% of their annual budgets into defence spending, but 5%, which would be a huge increase for countries like Canada and Britain. And it may be that he was talking about taking over Canada in less than entirely serious terms to make that point about security.
Sarah, many thanks. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith there. Well, let's get some reaction to this from Greenland, which, of course, is currently an autonomous territory of Denmark. Kuno Fenke is an MP for the Sumut Party. It's part of the governing coalition. He's also a member of the Foreign and Security Committee in the Parliament. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you, and thank you for the invite.
Well, what do you make of what Donald Trump has had to say? He's not ruling out using military force to make Greenland part of America.
Well, I agree actually quite a lot with Sarah's statements, and we have to say that Donald Trump is both a politician and a businessman, and he has very bold a bold rhetoric in regards to how he says things. And I saw that interview, and many of the questions were a little bit, you know, there were many questions at the same time, and I didn't really know when he was talking about Panama, Greenland, or Canada. But what I got about it was that he will certainly not rule out using economic force, if you can say that, in regards to Greenland, and not military. So,
well, how do you feel about that?
Well, we have been prepared in Greenland for some kind of connection and with the United States, and maybe some bold statements from the former president and president-elect. So,
well, connection or hostile takeover?
For a positive communication with Donald Trump and his administration.
Well, of course, his son, Donald Jr., has been in Greenland today, hasn't he? You didn't get a chance to speak to him.
No, I didn't. I was actually very busy today at work, so I didn't get a chance to go out and meet him. And,
it was a private visit, but his father, to whom he's very close, has been very clear that he wants to get some kind of control over Greenland. What would your message to him have been if you had had a chance to see him?
Well, I would say that once again, Greenland is not for sale, and its sovereignty and self-determination are non-negotiable. We welcome a constructive dialogue and mutually beneficial partnership with the United States and other nations. And we have the right, and Greenland aspiration to become a sovereign state is non-negotiable, but we are willing to talk with Denmark and the United States in regards to, like, maybe a double compact of free association. And we know our strategic position here in Greenland is very important for the security of the United States and Canada even. So
you're sounding like a deal maker. Do you think there's something to be done there that could benefit Greenland, could benefit people like you who are after sovereignty from this Trump approach?
Of course, I've also been a businessman and just got into politics, so maybe we can talk in similar ways with Donald Trump. But This is a decision that the Greenlandic people must take. It's not one politician's decision. So Denmark annexed us in 1953, and we will not continue that path. Of course, we will give the Greenlandic people the right for self-determination by a referendum for statehood or independence or any other kind of constellation like you have with the Canada, Australia, under the United Kingdom realm.
Kuno Fenke, Greenland MP, thanks very much indeed.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Well, Donald Trump also used his news conference to react to the news that Meta, the company behind social media platforms Facebook and Instagram, will be dispensing with independent fact checkers that it has been using to moderate content in the United States.
Facebook. I think they've come a long way. I watched it. The man was very impressive. I watched it. Actually, I watched it on Fox. I'm not allowed to say that. Say it.
Do you think he's directly responding to the threats that you have made to him in the past?
Probably. Yeah, probably.
The man he was referencing there was Facebook founder, CEO of Meta, Mark Zuckerberg, who announced the policy shift and specifically referenced the shifting political circumstances in the United States.
We're going to get rid of fact checkers and replace them with community notes similar to X, starting in the US. After Trump first got elected in 2016, the legacy media wrote nonstop about how misinformation was a threat to democracy. We tried in good faith to address those concerns without becoming the arbiters of truth. But the fact checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the US. So over the next couple of months, we're going to phase in a more comprehensive community notes system.
Donald Trump and his supporters have accused platforms like Facebook of censoring conservative voices, but campaigners against online hate speech have reacted with dismay to this change. John Samples is vice president of the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute. He's also a member of the 21-person oversight board established by Mark Zuckerberg in 2018 during the first Trump administration as an independent body to review content moderation decisions on the Meta platforms Facebook and Instagram. So what does he think of Mr. Zuckerberg's decision?
I think it represents a great change. Personally, I welcome it. I'm not sure. I'm on an oversight board at Meta. I'm not sure all my colleagues would. So I don't represent Meta or the oversight board in this case. I do think it is a needed turn toward greater laxity. And I agree essentially with Mr. Zuckerberg's analysis that the governments, particularly during the pandemic, had effectively got Meta to do censorship of political speech that should have been heard. For the business model and for the users themselves, that was not a good situation. And this is an attempt to get around that.
Do you think, though, since you talk about the pandemic, when it came to medical misinformation, which in some cases proved to be harmful, perhaps even fatal for people, that there was a role for that kind of fact-checking? There is a role still for that kind of fact-checking?
First of all, the pandemic may be such an unusual situation, but we have to remember, during the pandemic, Meta had 80 statements, many of which were extreme statements about medicine, that were taken down on site. Now, I don't think what Mr. Zuckerberg said today has anything to do with those 80 statements. But Meta also in that time had two other things happen. One was they took down on site the claims about the origins, human origins of the virus, and they put it back up. They admitted they made a mistake. The other thing was this opening up toward censorship by the government. The Biden White House leaned heavily on them. Nick Clegg, the former Deputy Prime Minister of Great Britain, said afterwards in an email that what the Biden administration was asking for in terms of censorship was well outside the traditions of American free speech. So I think not so much that we're going to see things about, you know, drinking bleach and things like that, but rather we're going to see what is in the mainstream conversation is not going to be taken down now. And speech that directly leads to harms will not be affected by this. What he's talking about is a number of things that were taken down essentially because they were, you know, the government didn't like it or they weren't popular speech.
Yeah, I mean, he said, didn't he, fact checkers have been politically biased. I mean, yes. is that not just the fault of who the fact checkers were or what they were being told to do? I mean, is there not a way of having unbiased fact checking?
I think the reason he's given up on it is because it wasn't credible to half of the United States. It just wasn't, because you looked at who was on those fact-checking boards and the kind of decisions they made, and what you saw was the same sort of people that were on the other side of the partisan line.
Isn't a large part of the reason for why he's done this, because he sees the way the political wind is blowing, he wants to stay on the right side of the incoming Trump administration, he's doing something for commercial reasons?
Well, he has an obligation to maximize shareholder value. However, I think his reasoning is more complicated. I think there's certainly a political concern here. For a long time, he was trying to placate Europe and the Digital Services Act, but now he sees that he's not going to be able to do that, and he's looking more toward an American administration that will be on the side of American companies. And that's going to be a big change. It's almost like a partnership with the Trump administration in advancing American companies.
Doesn't that have its own implication, though, in terms of if he's essentially becoming a social media arm of the state in that sense?
The problem here is that the state was going to be involved anyway. His choice was being forced by the fines that the European Commission and the Digital Service Act. So he's looking for someone to help him in the kind of jungle of digital world space. What we don't want to see is Meta or any of these companies going the other way and being an arm of the Trump administration, an arm of conservative interest groups, or anyone else. What we want is a broad free speech platform that in the end will serve the public interest.
And that was John Samples, a vice president of the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute, and member of the oversight board for Meta. Now, coming up later on.
I'm in this rocky granite wall mixed with ice on this balcony of rock in my tent, and I'm sleeping, and suddenly everything's moving around me, shaking, and I hear these explosions of ice.
Experiencing an earthquake on Mount Everest. We'll speak to the German climber who survived this morning's earthquake in the Himalayas. Should England boycott next month's Champions Trophy men's cricket match against Afghanistan to show their support for Afghan women who have been barred not just from taking part in sports, but from taking part in most things by the Taliban? Well, a crossbench group of 160 MPs and members of the House of Lords have signed a letter to the England and Wales Cricket Board calling for just that. And today they met the ECB. Its chief executive, Richard Gould, has said the ECB would not schedule bilateral matches against Afghanistan, but when it came to tournaments, all members of the sports international body, the ICC, should act together. In a statement, he had said a boycott of men's cricket could inadvertently help the Taliban and that cricket was a source of hope and positivity for many Afghans. The Labour MP for Gower, Tonya Antoniazzi, wrote the letter to the ECB.
I felt really strongly about this and put the feelers out with colleagues, cross-party, cross the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and realised that there was great feeling that this was for the ECB to make a stand and to consider boycotting the game.
Yes, there probably aren't too many issues you'd get Lord Kinnock and Nigel Farage to sign up together, but this clearly has struck a nerve.
Everybody feels very strongly about the treatment of women and girls, but also, you know, the first thing the Taliban did when they took over Afghanistan is to stop women playing sport. We know that that situation has deteriorated greatly and the situation there is untenable. And it was for us as parliamentarians to stand up and say, we have to do something about this. I had a meeting today with the ECB in order to iron out how we move forward, because we've got 6 weeks before the competition. The ECB have a very important platform on which they can speak out and consider boycotting the game.
Now, at the moment, The ECB is not planning to do that. It is saying that it's committed to finding a solution that upholds the rights of women and girls in Afghanistan while also considering the broader impact on the Afghan people.
Yes, and our letter was welcomed by Richard Gould because now that gives him a platform to be able to speak out and actually have a plan moving forward. But it's not their choice at present to boycott the game.
Do you accept any of what they're saying, though, in terms of the broader impact on the Afghan people? I mean, if we look at comparisons, this Afghan team, the men, they are in the main exiles from the country. It's a different situation, perhaps, to the one that was with South Africa.
They are mostly exiled. The women are permanently exiled at the moment. You know, you are in a situation where there is no grassroots cricket in Afghanistan. There is nothing coming through for, well, definitely not women and girls, and even less so for men. So how much longer they can continue to be playing as they do, I would like to know. But also this is an opportunity for them to be able to speak out, and we can empower them to do that.
Is there any danger, and this has been raised, I think, that this actually helps the Taliban?
Well, one of the comments that's been made to me was that, do you really think that the Taliban care? You're just playing into their hands. And I think that maybe they do, maybe they don't. However, we cannot be bystanders in what is happening in Afghanistan.
But surely if this isn't going to make any difference, you could argue, what is the point?
Well, just the attitude that we can't do anything about it, therefore we will do nothing about it, is not the reason why I and the people that signed that letter are in politics. That's the first thing. And the second thing is...
No, I suppose I would argue, is there a more effective way? If they're not going to listen to this, should you be focusing on more ways that would perhaps make a difference?
We have to use the global levers that we have. Standing up for women and girls, the softer politics of sport are very, very powerful. And that is what we saw during apartheid. And this is why we have to have our voices heard. And the ECB need to understand that they have influence over the ICC. They have boycotted the bilaterals, so have Australia. They need to be working together now and having their voice heard at the table.
And do you have any sense of where the players sit on this? The England players, it's again a bit awkward for them to be dragged into it, but there have been cases in the past where they have taken political stands, notably in the 2003 World Cup when England forfeited the game against Zimbabwe to protest at what Robert Mugabe was doing.
They will have opinions. And from the meeting today, there are actions moving forward that hopefully either if they individually want to give voice to the situation, they can. And also they could pull together a social media strategy or a communication strategy, which gets that message across about how uncomfortable or unhappy they are with the situation.
That was the Labour MP, Tonia Antoniazzi. Now, social media company has been making the news today, but that follows days when the owner of another has been roiling UK politics with his interventions on grooming gangs. The safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, gave her first reaction today to the posts on X by Elon Musk, in which the tech billionaire labelled her a rape genocide apologist and called for her to be jailed. He, of course, was responding to her rejection of a request for a new public inquiry into child sexual exploitation in Oldham. In her interview with Victoria Derbyshire for Newsnight, Jess Phillips defended her decision, arguing that local inquiries, such as the one in Telford, were more effective in bringing about change. And she responded to a question about her own security following Mr. Musk's posts on X.
Are you saying that as a result of some of Musk's tweets, that the threat to you has gone up and things are in place to protect your safety?
Yes.
How does that make you feel?
Resigned to the lot in life that you get as a woman who fights violence against women and girls. I've learnt that it's ups and downs in my life, but what it makes me know is I have to just keep on going.
Of course, Britain's is far from the only European country where the man who will soon be assuming a role in the new US administration has been making it clear where his political sympathies lie to his 211 million followers on X. Elon Musk has lent his high-profile support to parties on the populist right across the continent, much to the growing concern of their opponents. This week, the Norwegian Prime Minister called Elon Musk's involvement in European politics worrying. The French President Emmanuel Macron labelled it a direct intervention. Well, the European party that's perhaps gained the most clear seal of Musk approval is the AfD in Germany, where federal elections are, of course, taking place next month. This Thursday, Mr. Musk will be hosting a live stream on X with the party's co-leader, Alice Weidel. Well, we're joined now by Beatrix von Storch, who's an MP from AfD and vice chair of its parliamentary group. Good evening.
Good evening, James.
What do you say then to politicians like Emmanuel Macron, who say that you are, that Elon Musk is, what he says, supporting a new international reactionary movement and directly intervening in elections?
Well, what he's doing, he's using his right of free speech on his platform. Everyone else has free speech on his platform as well. Very, very clear that he has a huge group of followers and it has an impact what he's saying, but still it's free speech and we are very much in favour of it. So I can't say anything against it. And no one has ever questioned when any other billionaire started to speak out on behalf of, in favour of, you know, Kamala Harris or Hillary Clinton or the left-wing parties or the Green parties. They never, ever criticised it.
You did, though, didn't you? You and your party did.
Sorry?
Your party criticised that, though, didn't they?
No, I'm just saying no one criticised it when others intervened in or made their arguments in favour or against Trump or for Hillary Clinton and so forth. I'm just saying that now everyone is crying out loudly because now all of a sudden there is a very very powerful man who is in favour of AfD, and one can say we have not been supported by anybody. We've been censored. By Facebook and Twitter beforehand, and now it's the other way around.
So what you're saying is enough. Double standards, are you saying?
Yes.
But what about the fact that, I mean, the European Commission is now saying it's going to look into this live stream that Elon Musk is doing with your co-chair, saying that it's looking into whether X is spreading illegal content and manipulating information. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's just today that Mark Zuckerberg admitted that he has been pressured by the Biden administration to heavily censor the opinion of millions of people on his platform. And I think this is now changing. And I think this is very good that this is changing. And I hope we will see the same thing here. I mean, it's just ridiculous that they are coming up with debate on illegal content because Musk is talking to Alice Weidel. What the hell can be illegal about this talk, except that it's a huge platform for AfD, and maybe he's not all against us
Others. Yeah, can I just ask you, when you see what's happened with Nigel Farage here in the UK and Elon Musk turning against him, are you not wary of his support? He can flip, can't he?
Look, what will not happen with Elon Musk and Alice Weidel tomorrow or on Thursday, most likely, she will not be interrupted by Elon Musk and maybe she has the chance to speak three or four sentences in a whole without being interrupted, like we are interrupted by BBC, like you're interrupting me when I try to make a sentence.
It's called asking questions.
And this is what you're all afraid. This is what you're all afraid of, that we get a huge audience without getting interrupted. So this interview with you and me is maybe just showing, we will then see what's the difference between the way Musk is treating her. And this is why you're also afraid that we get a huge platform, which is even bigger than BBC, which is going down
We have given you a platform on several times on this occasion and on this programme.
And you're always interrupting me.
Well, it's called asking questions. It's part of democracy. But thank you very much for joining us, Beatrix von Storch, MP from the AfD. Now, rescue workers have been struggling in freezing temperatures in a remote area of Tibet near Mount Everest today to reach survivors of an earthquake in the foothills of the Himalayas. So far, 126 people are confirmed to have died. Access for aid organisations, let alone journalists, to the region is heavily restricted by China. But tremors were also experienced in neighbouring Nepal and Bhutan in northern India. Ekdev Adhikari leads the National Emergencies Operation Centre in Nepal.
My team now is assessing the situation, and coordination was established with the local authorities, first responders. But we have the difficulty of the rock terrains, highest Himalayan terrain, including some of the world's highest peaks. And this time is winter season, so the temperature is also freezing.
Well, it's been very difficult to get through to the villagers who've been directly affected by the earthquake. But we did manage to catch up with one of the climbers on Mount Everest who experienced it. The 32-year-old German, Jost Kobusch, was trying to become the person to scale the world's tallest mountain in winter. The first person to scale the world's tallest mountain in winter alone and without extra oxygen. And he began by telling me where he was when the earthquake struck.
I was in my camp at 5,700 meters on Everest. And you have to imagine, it's not the normal route on Everest. I'm in this rocky granite wall mixed with ice on this balcony of rock in my tent. And I'm sleeping and suddenly everything's moving around me, shaking. And I hear these explosions of ice and I see these avalanches and pressure waves hit me. And like, was quite a spicy moment.
A spicy moment. That's one way of describing it. Well, what did you do immediately?
My brain was going through a checklist of like, can I be hit by ice chunks here? No. Okay. Is the tent secured? Yes. And then it was just like, okay, I've done my homework. So now just let's see what happens. I was just observing, since I knew that I had carefully selected this camp spot. I was just looking out of these little windows of my tent and seeing how all these avalanches were like going down, all these ice chunks were falling down the rocks. And then I quickly realized that not so far from my position, a big serac, which is like an ice tower of a glacier, had collapsed and it had exploded and the pressure wave was basically shooting towards me. I was just leaning a little bit against the tent to support against the pressure wave. but there is no time. Like, I'm in my pajamas kind of like, and we're on Everest in the winter. You're not just going out in your socks or anything in that environment. It's extremely windy, cold, dangerous, just on its own without an earthquake.
You say we, you're on your own though, aren't you? And you don't have oxygen.
Exactly. Did I say we?
The royal we.
You know, sometimes my brain goes into we because I think somehow subconsciously it just creates the illusion somebody's there to help me, you know?
What did you do next?
Basically, the shockwave hit the tent and some little chunks pierced the tent and some parts broke. Then I checked and there were no further collapses and the avalanches were about to like roll down and come to an end. So now it's basically just like, okay, look, there's probably like some aftershocks and stuff. It would be wisest to just stay here, wait and see until things settle down a bit. So what I did was I went back to sleep, slept another 2 hours.
And you're able to sleep, were you?
Look, this is my job. I'm a professional alpinist. I can sleep in the most craziest spots.
Now, I wonder if the fact you're able to sleep was because you've, I think, have experienced an earthquake before in this same region.
A stronger one in 2015, and bigger ice masses came down the mountain and created an avalanche that was gigantic and it hit the base camp. That was a very intense moment.
What of the mission? What of the climb? Where do things stand at the moment?
The mission is to climb Everest in the winter solo without oxygen via the West Ridge, a technical route. In 1984, a team managed to reach 7,500 meters in altitude on that climb. So the goal for this expedition was to break that record. And in the beginning of the winter, I actually already pulled that off. So right now, already feeling very successful for this season, even though the summit is still very far.
The climber, Jost Kobusch. In the long and controversial political career of Jean-Marie Le Pen, the French far-right leader who's died at the age of 96, the high point was one I witnessed for myself when I was the BBC's Paris correspondent. It came on April the 21st, 2002, when the leader of the National Front, a fierce opponent of immigration, a Holocaust denier, shocked the French establishment by making it into the runoff of the presidential election, beating the sitting socialist Prime Minister Lionel Jospin into third place. Wails of anguish at the Jospin headquarters as they realise the unthinkable has happened. Their socialist candidate is an also-ran in this election, relegated to third place behind President Chirac and the far-right leader Jean-Marie Le Pen. No one in France doubts the significance of what has happened. Well, Le Pen went on to be crushed by Jacques Chirac in the second round, but it was a breakthrough that eventually paved the way for his daughter Marine to change the name and the image of the party, not just making it acceptable, but eminently electable. Today, the National Rally has the most seats of any single party in the National Assembly, and she's in a strong position to succeed Emmanuel Macron. Well, today, in a studiously non-committal statement, the French president said, "History will judge the legacy of Jean-Marie Le Pen." Jean-Yves Camus is a political scientist who specialises in the European far right. How does he think Jean-Marie Le Pen will be remembered?
Historians, at least, will remember him as the man who rebuilt the French extreme right. When Le Pen created the Front National in 1972, he had less than 100 dupe-paying members. And 10 years later, he was about to enter the European Parliament, getting 10% of the vote, and eventually he rose to 16% in 2002. Le Pen was a man who understood that identity and immigration would come at the forefront of the political debate, and he focused on that.
What was it about him, though, as a politician that made the extreme right popular?
He was the son of a fisherman from Brittany. He could tell people, "Look, I started very low. I succeeded in life, and you can do the same, except that you are denied the right to achieve a decent life because of foreigners." And he was also a very gifted spokesman. Most politicians spoke about technical issues. Le Pen spoke to the guts on immigration, identity. That made him popular.
What about the infamous comment in 1987 that the gas chambers were a detail of history? How much damage did that do to him?
Oh, the damage was really big. I think that made an alliance between the National Front and the mainstream right totally impossible. Saying that he was not sure that the gas chambers existed was really so much beyond the pale.
Yet, 15 years later, in 2002, and I was in Paris when that happened, that seismic shock on the 21st of April when he got through to the second round of the presidential election, and it's perhaps hard to remember just how big a moment that was for France.
In the first round, there were the highest number of candidates in any election, any presidential election under the Fifth Republic. So, mathematically, it was easier for him to get on the second ballot because the threshold was lower. But he could not win. What he said on the inequality of races, what he said on the Second World War, that just kept so many French people away from voting for him.
But with his daughter Marine Le Pen, things are very different. Would you say that how she has managed her relationship with her late father, has that been key to one of the keys to her growing popularity?
As a politician, she very quickly understood that it was not possible to continue the party on the lines of Jean-Marie Le Pen, especially when it came to anti-Semitism and racism. But she was wise enough to maintain private contact with her father, but fighting him politically, up to the point when, in 2015, she stripped him of his honorary chairmanship of the party.
The political scientist Jean-Yves Camus on Jean-Marie Le Pen. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. For now, from me and everyone here, good night.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.